I had a conversation recently with some engineers at a very large scale, multi-billion scale company, and they were explaining that their backlog of incident follow-ups was about 70,000 tickets for a company that only has about 20,000 engineers. And so, if you think about that, it means that like systematically, we're kind of they're sitting down thinking about the right things to go execute, and then they're just going on a backlog somewhere. And so the question is, like, are they just being, really overly optimistic about like the crazy grandiose things that they could actually be doing to solve these problems? Or is it just that like there's not enough energy being put into executing the follow-ups?
Welcome to the Reliability Rebels podcast, where we improve production by challenging the status quo. Your host, Armin Astani from Cherto Modo.
Check one, check two.
Reliability Rebels.
Check one, check two.
Reliability Rebels.
Check, 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 check.
Welcome to the Reliability Rebels podcast, where we explore how to make software and systems more reliable by challenging the status quo. I am your host, Amin Astani. Working at a big tech company is like living on another planet. Everything from infrastructure management to incident response operates on a completely different scale and requires a different mindset and tools to effectively navigate. Today, we explore that world with Derek Brown, engineering lead at Plaid. I met Derek at the SevZero Incident Management Conference last fall, where he did a talk about why small incidents matter. We learned that we share the experience of working at Meta's production engineering, so I'm excited to compare notes with him. In addition to that, Derek is an attorney for the state of California, a scuba diver, a ham radio operator, an experimental chef, and a drummer. So, we're going to have a really fun conversation today. Derek, welcome to the show.
Thank you so much, Mean.
Awesome. So usually at the beginning of the episode, I have my guests introduce themselves. Now, you're obviously a very interesting fellow. So as concise as you can manage, tell us all about yourself.
Yeah, that's absolutely a tall order. I think the organizing principle to a lot of the things I do is I just really enjoy learning and challenging myself in all the things I think you mentioned earlier, whether it's engineering, being an attorney, being a scuba diver, being a chef. I like to find things that are like challenging and interesting and drive curiosity. So that's a common theme across all of those things. To kind of highlight the big two, maybe career oriented aspects of my life. One is engineering. I think as I'm sure many of our listeners can relate, I grew up with Legos and trying to solve engineering problems, and software was kind of the logical next step for me because you could kind of make really amazing things from nothing. That kind of motivated my interest in the engineering world. I think the legal world is a little bit more difficult to explain, but I grew up in a household where my mom was very involved in local government, and I kind of got to see both the really positive and really negative sides of that. The positive being like the amazing work that they get to do for kids and responding to weather incidents and like all the things that go into local government and planning. But then kind of the hard side of it is like it's a group of people who fight really hard every day, and it's a very thankless job. And so I think the legal avenue was a way for me to kind of add that to my toolbox of tools I could apply to solve world problems. So I'm looking forward to maybe making those two things intersect more in the future, but it certainly puts an interesting kind of color and spin on a lot of my engineering work.
Appreciate that. Yeah, solving problems sometimes involves not just the technical aspect, but the people aspect. And it's admirable that you're trying to solve real problems, perhaps with the legal training and experience that you have. That's a really unique and cool background. Thank you for sharing.
Definitely something I think have grown to appreciate the more and more I get into it, that rooms I previously wouldn't have gotten to be involved with, I get to be involved with there. So.
No, for sure. For sure.
Looking to scale your SaaS product or IT department without the usual headaches and costs? Check out Cherto Modo's rapid assessment of production in depth. For a flat fee, you will get a personalized, actionable roadmap to make your systems more scalable and reliable, all based on best practices from top tech companies and host Armin Astani's practical experience. Here's a real testimonial from a previous client.
As a technical leader. It's like a tangible document that you can give to an engineering team or a product team and be like, okay, here's the recommendations. Go create the stories, go implement those things. You have that direction. So it's just good knowing that you have that document, you trust the source that it's coming from, and it's the right things to do for your company at this time. And it's not just like, I read this blog article on the internet and it tells me to do this. And no, we vetted it with you, and that's valuable.
You can scale smarter, no extra hires needed. Learn more at chertomodo.io. Thanks for listening. Now, back to the show.
We briefly mentioned you work at Plaid as an engineering lead. Now, for those that might not know, because we have, there's like 10 billion SaaS companies out there now with different names. What does Plaid do, and what does your role entail?
Yeah. Besides being an awesome fabric, Plaid, the SaaS company, is currently kind of one of the deepest, longest running fintechs in the US, and growing internationally as well. And so Plaid's kind of flagship product, when we were talking about Plaid in the legacy sense, was a transactions mm-hmm. product. And so you who wanted to go build a fintech product or wanted to integrate different financial institutions together would use Plaid, and that would connect your SaaS product with all the different financial institutions. And we do the legwork of collecting data via APIs or through browser connections to those various banking institutions or financial products and pull that all together. So you could then go build your own credit insights or insurance product or mortgage product or what have you. And as Plaid has gotten more mature, we're also kind of expanding the we'll say vertical integration in that space. So we acquired Cognito about a year ago that does identity verification. And then we're now offering kind of higher orders of abstraction above that transactions data. So also in about February of last year, we introduced a credit reporting agency product. So if you're familiar with like Experian or TransUnion, that kind of deduce your entire financial life down to a point scale. And the thesis behind Plaid's product is that we're able to use ML and all the additional data that we have about you, you know, that you give us access to through the Plaid experience, to give you like lenders a more holistic picture, and that unlocks credit to many Americans who were, you know, underserved previously, and yeah, kind of I say Americans, but expanding well into international markets as well. But I think that was kind of the thesis when Plaid started.
Yeah, so we're talking financial pass as well as SaaS. It looks like you're operating on multiple levels here, not just to the regular consumer, but also to companies that need financial capabilities.
Yeah, we have a very wide range of clients and customers, ranging all the way from kind of the very modern fintech products that are, you know, very, very deep into ML and data insights, all the way to larger banking institutions and mortgage institutions. So it really runs the gamut, across many different verticals.
Oh, that's really, really cool. Besides the obvious, because fintech has a certain level of reliability and compliance requirements in order to properly function, right? It's not your usual SaaS company. It's higher stakes. What experiences are unique to working at a fintech company like Plaid from a reliability perspective?
I think you hit the nail on the head up front, which is with all of this, the kind of the degree of risk if you make mistakes, both from a reliability and a correctness standpoint, can be very high. You know, we both came from the Meta background where you're often asking yourself, like, what is the impact of, you know, a partial Instagram outage? And, you know, sure, there's a dollar amount cost to, you know, you as the company, but the impacts are relatively well understood, versus as a financial integrator, the impact can be downstream to big financial institutions or our customers and clients. And so that can be a difficult thing to even understand what the impact of reliability is. I think the other interesting aspect of this is that we operate kind of as an integrator and a data partner to many other institutions. And so our reliability isn't necessarily something that we have control, you know, over the full stack. I think, you know, again, many of your listeners might be, you know, running on public cloud, and you kind of have to deal with the like nuances of that public cloud's availability. You know, we at Plaid have thousands of financial institutions that are actually the back end to our application. When you call us to go get data from, you know, whatever, Acme, or fake bank, we have to go get that data from them. And so if that bank's APIs or website are unavailable, there's nothing we could really do. And so that makes our challenge really interesting, because we're papering over problems that we see with those backend integrations, or in many cases having to provide kind of a state machine to give our clients a good experience, even though banks have different different like reliability standards themselves or different correctness standards.
Sure. So the ability to gracefully degrade when these banks or institutions go down or are slow or, you know, misbehave is a really key piece of the experience for Plaid then, yes?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think, you know, one of the questions we have to ask is like, you know, why do people come and pick Plaid as a product? And this is kind of the key ability is, you know, interacting with all these institutions is very hard because they do accounting in different ways and they're up and down at various points and a very non-standard interface. And it takes a whole team to be able to maintain all of those integrations. And so that's part of the value that I think Plaid provides, is it gives you this really like great operating experience on top of banking transactions and institutions and credit, so that our customers can then focus on like the things that make their business unique rather than, you know, oops, someone changed their UI, I guess I need to rewrite that bank integration.
Yeah, daunting. What role do you play specifically in building and operating and keeping this system, this product online?
Yeah. So right now I am leading our service and network foundation team. So kind of a component of our infrastructure team that is working to kind of componentize many of the bits of that complexity. The biggest piece is networking for sure. We have a bunch to evolve internally in the ways that we network between services, and then as well how we network externally, both, you know, requests coming into our clusters and requests going out. And I think it's something that, you know, you can kind of see the magic sauce at work at Google or Metascale, where those platforms networks are just really incredible in the amount of complexity and self-healing and observability you just get out of the box with service discovery and with, you know, the network layer. And that's not something I've kind of seen available to the small to medium sized company and the, you know, complete out of the box offering. So it's something we're working on, is bringing service mesh on board and providing observability and rate limiting and visualization and fault injection and stuff of that order into our services. And then I also play kind of a broader role within kind of our infrastructure and platform teams when I'm not very deep in that. I'm kind of the T-shaped individual. Sure. So a lot of kind of product consulting, working with service owners to make sure their service is more resilient. And a little bit of the legal background comes in as well when we talk about like privacy and security stuff. So being a smaller company, you do get to have a lot of exposure to the entire set of changes that are going on at any given time.
Oh, wow. So you're actually using your legal background as part of your role at Plaid, like that you are an informed expert and can lend that experience to bear in that setting.
Yeah, I have to, you know, I have to be careful about how I leverage my legal background, because I'm certainly not a counsel representing Plaid. Sure. But I think there is actually a really natural synergy between, you know, attorneys and engineering, especially as we get to like more, you know, complexly regulated places. I think that was an experience I had at Meta, was that a lot of engineering was driven by compliance or privacy or security decisions. And it kind of felt like that was a conversation I wasn't, you know, privy to, because you got handed this list of requirements of like, here's why you need to keep your application, you know, XYZ private or secure or whatever. And I think having that background lets me maybe refine those policies a little bit more than I probably would be able to if I didn't actually understand like the mechanics of CCPA or BIPA or like any of these like privacy, you know, regimes.
Wow. Yeah, that's very, very interesting. Puts you in a very competitive place in the marketplace. Aren't that many people that can speak that language? That's awesome. So a couple times you've mentioned big tech companies, particularly Meta. You and I both did a tour of duty there right around the same time. So from your perspective, what do you want listeners to know about what it's like to work at a place like that, especially those who might be, you know, preparing to interview right now or is setting up big tech as a career goal, right? What should they know about a place like that?
I mean, that is, you know, I could write an opus about the things, I'm sure you could too, about all the things to learn about Meta or strategies on, you know, interviews for Meta or whatnot. I mean, I think the overwhelming thing I have told people about my experience at Meta and, you know, those considering big tech is I think it is a really excellent place to kind of learn those skills. I think if you're in a much smaller startup environment, you spend a much larger, you know, duty cycle executing, and you don't necessarily get the space to learn. And a lot of times, if you're kind of mid-career, there may not even be people within your team or organization that you can learn from or have the time to kind of teach and mentor you. And so I think that that is one thing to kind of keep in mind as you're, you know, starting a career, you know, those kind of leaving college or like starting their kind of first jobs, is that Meta does have a lot of great, or Meta and other kind of similar tech companies have a lot of great, you know, internships, co-ops, you know, early career opportunities where you can spend more of your time learning. I also think, and this may be obvious, but I think is probably worth repeating, is I think a lot of the experience at big tech companies varies so much team to team, role to role, manager to manager. Yes. And I think the piece of advice that was given to me when I was starting out, you know, looking for roles, was like the most important thing is just how much you like your, you know, hiring manager. Mm-hmm. And I think that's certainly true of the Meta, Google, Microsoft kind of thing companies, is your experience is very much dictated by like your relationship with your manager, how they're coaching you, the projects that they're helping you take on. And so, you know, whether that's a conversation you're having like before you get hired into the role, or that's a conversation you're having as part of like boot camp or, you know, team placement within that organization, I would put a lot of energy onto that decision, you know, because a good manager can really set up your next growth steps.
For sure. Let's take a step back and add a little bit of a glossary, because we're using some terms that folks might not understand. So when you mentioned boot camp, one of the things that is, of course, very different than a regular tech job, like you apply for a position, the hiring manager is known. When you apply for a larger organization like Meta or Google or whatnot, that isn't necessarily defined when you apply. So when you get accepted for the job and you start for the first day, there's this period where you're getting onboarded. At Meta, we call that boot camp. They teach us all of the various tools and processes in terms of participating as an engineer at the job. But then there's this period around week 5 or 6 where you start shopping around for teams to actually join. So you, the newly minted employee, have a lot of choices. You're not applying for a specific role on a team. You are applying for the opportunity to choose a team.
Right. Yeah, I think as I kind of remember my experience going through that, I think that was actually kind of, I thought it was a risk as an outside person, where like, yeah, you know, all my other jobs, I'd known exactly who I was going to be working at and what I'd be doing. But I think there is, yeah, there's also this view of like, it's an opportunity.
Yes.
There's so many teams, and it kind of lets you pick the role that kind of fits, you know, your growth goals, your interests. I remember I kind of worked with for about a week, 3 or 4 different teams before I settled on like the program I wanted, like the team I wanted to join. And I think that's probably a better way than, you know, picking a team you've never really gotten a chance to meet and work with over the phone, right? So incredible opportunity.
Yeah, definitely. I envy you, because I was pre-allocated, because I was joining a satellite office, which was the Cambridge, you know, near Boston office. So there was one team available, and that was Conveyor, which is the planetary scale CI/CD system. There's papers about Conveyor if you listeners are interested. I had a very brief stint in Conveyor and then ended up in service management.
One thing maybe your viewers can kind of or listeners can maybe glean from this information is kind of an answer to a common question I get, which is like, what are the tools and frameworks and technologies that I need to learn to go land a job at big tech company? And I think the fact that they have a bootcamp program where basically theoretically, they'll let you choose being an Android engineer or an iOS engineer or a web stack engineer or like a little bit of an infra platform engineer based on, you know, the interview process you've already done. I think shows that these big tech companies are kind of treating your programming language knowledge and framework knowledge as, you know, like pretty convertible between different stacks. And so that's where when people ask that question of like, you know, what tech stack should I be learning, I kind of say like, you get to choose, like whatever you want to go explore is really the best thing for you in your career. Don't freak out too much that, you know, oh, Meta uses PHP, I got to go learn PHP. Like that's not how really anyone joining the company went about learning PHP. They had a lot of logical experience building programs and then learned PHP as a means to accomplish the things that they were assigned in their job.
Yeah, that is a very, very huge insight. The advice I tend to give people, because I've had similar questions before, of course, and I've even written blog posts about this, and the way that I tend to approach it is, okay, do you know how to code in a language? It doesn't matter which one, but can you write code in a language if you were, you know, given a programming problem? Could you solve it? Data structures, algorithms, that sort of thing, depending if you're, you know, SRE or software eng, it depends on how much algorithms you do. And then, do you understand systems? Do you understand, you know, scheduling processes? Do you understand system calls? Do you understand signals? Do you understand, you know, all of those OS primitives? So we're not saying, oh, you got to learn Kubernetes. Well,
no.
Because frankly, those systems don't have that scheduler. They've written their own. So you need to understand the underlying substrate, the fundamentals. Can you code? Do you understand systems? And that, if you know that well, you can get in.
And I think that's actually really an excellent use of AI I found in my work, you know, especially in the last like year or so, is, you know, maybe you're really, really deep on, you know, Golang or, you know, Python as a stack. Like, you can kind of just turn to, you know, ChatGPT or whatever and say like, well, this, I know how to do this in Python. Tell me how I go do this, you know, idiomatically in Go. And it will give you a pretty good response. And so I think that unlocks it. It almost becomes like a tech stack translator where you can kind of say like, you know, I'm really familiar with like how Redis works. Like, please explain to me any of the changes that I might need to go to migrate this to like some specific elastic cached setting that I need to go find, right? Mm-hmm. You can really take your experiences with, you know, deep knowledge of one system and translate that into like very generic knowledge across a lot of systems. And that's really powerful.
Yeah. Yeah, that's a very, very good point. So knowledge is indeed transferable. Are there any services or tools at Meta that you miss, that you wish you had access to now in your current job?
I think you're smiling, which is giving me the indication that we both probably have the same answer. I think Meta's observability stack is really special. Right. I worked on the observability team, so I'm a little bit biased. I think the kind of pervasiveness of metrics logging, like everything had a really good set of metrics. It was very easy to kind of plug around and discover like what you needed to monitor, whether that's, you know, for performance or cost or for, you know, your incident investigation. And then their kind of semi-structured logging stack, it's I think also in the open domain, called Scuba. That basically lets you do real-time queries against, you know, massive data sets. It was fantastic for being able to drill down in an incident and figure out, you know, what's the cross-section of different, you know, attributes that were leading to this particular error. And I've certainly seen that kind of evolve in the last, you know, maybe 5 years ago. I don't think there was really open source offerings. I'm beginning to see stuff emerge in SaaS and open source that starts to look like that. But I think the gap still is, you really need a team of people who are actually going to go integrate that and like, ensure that all the service owners are logging in the right way and consuming it in the right way. And so I think what was special about the Meta observability ecosystem was the quality of the tools is there, but then they also had invested a lot in the deep integrations between the different tools and into the services to make observability a really great experience. And I think every company I have kind of interacted with, large and small, where I've kind of talked about what is your logging stack or what does your metric stack look like, is kind of playing catch up to that goal, which I think is interesting.
Yeah, 100%. I think the company that is starting to maybe approach Meta's, you know, how Scuba worked in that workflow is Honeycomb. And of course, Honeycomb's founder, Charity Majors, formerly worked for Meta. So she saw firsthand the power of what Scuba enabled you to do, and she took on the task to make that accessible to any engineering team, which is a very daunting one because of the, you know, the data retention requirements and is it even a profitable thing to do, you know, outside of FANG. So it is really, really interesting stuff. Yes, Scuba was the answer. You answered correctly.
I think Honeycomb is one example. I'll throw out a grab bag too. I think if viewers are interested in kind of hearing some of that, you know, angle, I think I've seen a lot of investment in ClickHouse. You know, it's something I've run open source, and it's kind of it's a Scuba-esque backend. You do have to kind of build your own front end experience to Scuba, but I think I've seen a lot of different shops using that as like the where they're going with logging infrastructure. And then I also think Frankly, I have there's few things in the software world that are as dominant as, like, I think Prometheus is at the moment. You know, when we talk about monitoring, like, no conversation happens without at some point mentioning Prometheus. And I think that's pretty incredible, given most other things we talk about, there's like two or three different flavors. And the fact that that hasn't been hard forked yet is fascinating. And so I expect visualizations and other similar experiences will come along, you know, over time.
No, for sure. Prometheus is pretty sticky, even with all of like the things you have to watch out for in terms of cardinality, and you can just fill up your disk or generate a lot of IO load if you don't configure your monitoring properly. But yes, like Prometheus is a great tool to get started if you want to pull something off the open source shelf. I just remember in the days when we were running Nagios, which was a complete, it's tantamount to banging rocks together.
Oh, very familiar. I was the one who killed Nagios at Meta.
Oh, yeah?
Yeah. I don't know how much I can say more about that, but it was a fun time.
All right. That's a statement. I salute you. That's a, oof. Okay. Yeah. You know, I can only imagine what the implication of that is, having a Nagios in a stack like that.
Yeah. I mean, I don't think it was used as a full stack monitoring solution, but I think I think it was a lot of the classic, like, who really wants to delete? You don't want to be the one who deletes the alerts, right? And so Meta did have a lot of kind of cruft within the observability team where they were relying on a monitoring system to monitor the monitoring system. I think that's since evolved a long way, but at the time was something we were dealing with.
For sure. I did not know that. So TIL, that Nagios was there at some point. Okay, so let's continue our tour of the big tech ecosystem and processes together here and reminisce a bit. So let's talk about reliability, right? So when you're working on improving reliability in these large environments, as I have as well, you know, what are your favorite tools or frameworks or processes? I'm not necessarily asking specific technology, but maybe certain ways of going about doing things.
Yeah, a great question. I mean, I think first and foremost, I think it's worth like acknowledging how difficult this is. I think probably a lot of practitioners have experienced this, where you have a series of incidents, or you have a big incident, and then there was a ton of interest in reliability, and then that kind of wanes as things kind of sit there and work correctly, and then that kind of interest in reliability swings again when you have those incidents. And so I think maintaining the steady state of energy and resources devoted to reliability projects is a really hard thing to advocate for, because it's not necessarily the highest, you know, impact for the business, but at the same time, something that just needs to happen. And so maybe not a singular framework, but I think the first order of business is really to find a way to articulate the value of those reliability projects to the business as a whole. You know, the first thing that kind of comes to mind is like find some set of numbers, whether that's like SLOs or like you have some other kind of performance indicators that are saying, you know, here's where we are in terms of reliability, and being able to just put a line on that graph to say, this is where we're going. And that gives everyone something to kind of rally behind. And you can then dive into those metrics and submetrics and figure out where are the places that we can actually, you know, make improvements. To kind of give an example, I think as an industry, we've gone through a lot of iterations around like what incident metrics we care about. Is it number of incidents? Is it the mean time to acknowledge the incident? Is the mean time to resolve the incident? And I think the answer is like kind of all of those things, right? You have to think about, you know, are you doing a good job of actually scheduling people on a rotation so that they're near their phone and their laptop to be able to resolve an incident? Are they wasting time reading docs before they're able to go find the, you know, mitigation lever? Like, are the mitigation levers too slow to roll out? Like, you have to kind of think through all of those submetrics to kind of bubble up to that, you know, upper level metric. And I think having data to be able to say, here's actually, we need to go invest in each of those steps in the process, I think is huge.
Yeah, that's super insightful. That's super insightful. With my clients, I tend to say, hey, top level metric is SLO, because that's what the customer is seeing. But you bring up a very interesting point that all of those, you know, like the old school MTTR has gotten a lot of bad rap recently, and for good reason, because a lot of organizations start and end there. But MTTR is useful if you're trying to explain, well, why did my error budget get spent? Because if the time to recover from an incident is extended, well, okay, fine. You're still going to be solving that problem. It's just that MTTR explains your SLO it isn't the only metric that you capture.
Yeah, I think people tend to play kind of funny games with MTTR. Like one of the conversations I think I've had basically continuously is like, what is the cut line for filing an incident? Because, you know, have this kind of push of like, file more incidents, it helps us have better discussions and like identify things quickly. You know, on the flip side, like if you file a bunch of incidents, you're going to like wreck these metrics and like incident count, you're creating a bunch of noise and like extra work for the team. And so MTTR is one of those things where these subjective determinations about like, is this an incident or not, or how many incidents should we be filing, end up affecting this thing you're saying is like a kind of a very objective metric of like company performance. And so that's where, you know, the SLO is probably the indicator you're actually watching and you care about driving that number. But some of these other metrics are like are diagnostic metrics in the same way as you have them for a service that kind of help you figure out like, where do I have, you know, minutes to shave off investigation or response time or services that are flaky during deployments or whatever it is that you can like go after and address.
Mm-hmm. No, that makes a lot of sense. You're speaking my language, man. This is great. Let's look at how incident response and postmortems are done, because they're done a little differently in larger scale companies like Meta and Google. So what's something that you've changed in terms of how you run that process over time based on what you've learned from those environments?
Yeah, I mean, I'll start with, like, frankly, I think a lot of what I've learned have come from those environments. I think, you know, obviously the large scale tech companies have more incidents probably combined than the rest of the industry because they have the time to go, you know, file those incidents and have that high line of, you know, rigor. And so their processes are really, you know, tightly tuned. And if you have the opportunity to like learn from someone who has those experiences or they're putting out white papers, like, those are a pretty solid kind of indication of like, I think how you should be running incidents because they've just refined those processes super well. And it's also something I think I tell everyone who joins my team, the kind of infrastructure platform side, is like, absolutely go to incident review because, you know, even if you're not the one being reviewed, you're not even, maybe you're not a higher level IC that has a significant sway in how that, you know, incident shook out. Patterns emerge the more you just kind of sit in that room and like, you know, bake in all of the different failure modes and like communication styles and everything that's kind of going on. And so I think first and foremost, just like exposure is really, really key. I think really what we've kind of, I think the main things that have differed from the large scale environment now coming back to smaller ones is where we put the kind of energy of the rigor. I think in a large scale environment, it feels a lot more like a checkbox where like you've met some criteria, the incident is filed. There's like a contract about like you write the follow-ups and those follow-ups have to get executed in 30 days and you can't like recategorize them. It's almost a contract you're making to like the rest of the organization and the business. And sometimes I've kind of seen that devolve into like almost a punitive thing at larger companies where, oh, well, you like made me, you know, blocked my deploys for 2 hours. Like you should file an incident because like you need to kind of suffer because I suffered. And I'm not saying that's the average. I think that's like, you know, 1% of the case, but it does really quickly devolve into that. That's not something I think people write about or talk about openly. Versus, you know, I think within the smaller scale environment, you know, we're about a roughly, you know, high school sized group of engineers. And so we all know each other. We're not going to go file petty incidents for each other. It's a lot more about learning rather than, you know, strict process. And so one of the things we've instituted is we actually ask upfront, like, what are the key learnings that we're looking for out of this retro? And so you might then just skip the entire process of, okay, I'm not going to go write a detailed timeline of this incident because we have a pretty good understanding. I'm not going to go down to the second level timeline, you know, timelines. Or kind of the same thing if you've had a repeat incident, like maybe you've had this, you know, incident three times, you roughly know what it is. It's not worth re-explaining it to a new room of reviewers, like what happened. You know, maybe you could kind of have to step back and look at the pattern. And I think that's kind of the main difference. I think we actually stick pretty closely to that, the kind of general industry best practices around incident retro.
Yeah, no, that makes a lot of sense. And in our last conversation, when we were preparing for this podcast, you were talking about this practice of meta sev analysis, not Meta the company, but, you know, looking at past incidents in aggregate to glean learnings, not just from an individual incident, but in general from a production system. Tell us a little bit about that.
Yeah, it's a practice we've started relatively recently at Plaid. It's an exercise I've actually done all the way going back to Meta. I think in the context of an incident, we tend to hyper-focus on the specific root cause of that incident. Like if it's a bug, the question is like, what's the missing testing? What's the missing monitoring? You kind of fall into these really common patterns. I think it can be hard to spot maybe some of the like organizational problems or overall process problems when you're looking at that only, like that singular incident, because it doesn't really, maybe you don't have the pattern established from that one incident. And so piecing together the history of incidents over like maybe a quarter or a year or half, whatever that is, and starting to bucket and understand maybe some of the broader themes can really be helpful to the organization. So kind of things we've pulled out is if you have a string of incidents that are all caused by a similar misunderstanding about how a system works, constantly saying we're just going to document it isn't going to help you. Like maybe you actually need to go buy down some of the complexity in that system to just make it easier to edit. It could be the case that you see incidents where it takes a long time to resolve because, you're not getting the right people in the room early enough, or people aren't aware that the change is happening. And so you end up investing in like better release practices or better change log, better pre-mortems. And so it's those kind of things I think you can spot when you're looking at the constellation of incidents across a company rather than, singular ones. And then it's actually an exercise we've taken down to the team level. So I think our main meta incident review is something that we look at as like reliability leads to try to propose changes on like more of an organizational level. But it's also something we're starting on a team basis. And that kind of has a different purpose where we're just blitzing through all the incidents. We've all lived them at 2 a.m. at some point. And so what we're trying to do in that is actually look at the follow-ups and just make sure that we're actually getting solid resolution prevention things in place, because I think things kind of tend to fall off the bandwagon sometimes. And so being able to look at 3 or 4 incidents as a responder and say like, well, we're not actually in a really good state if this happened again today, 90 days later is a good thing to do as well.
Yeah, for sure. During my time at Meta, I remember just going over all of the past sevs and then looking at all of the follow-up tasks that were filed. And usually I was the one who filed them because I was the champion of all this stuff. But like trying to cross-reference which task mapped to which, sevs, and trying to figure out which ones if acted upon would, kill many birds with one stone. It's a big task. And I've noticed that some organizations will be very one and done when it comes to the postmortem process. They'll do the write up. It'll be very detailed. They'll have the full blow by blow, the time frames, everything in UTC, absolutely beautiful. But then after they present it, they don't read it again. And that's such a huge loss of organizational knowledge that could be used, right?
Yeah. I had a conversation recently with some engineers at a very large scale, multi-billion scale company, and they were explaining that backlog of incident follow-ups was about 70,000 tickets for a company that only has about 20,000 engineers. And so if you think about that, it means that like systematically, we're kind of, they're sitting down thinking about the right things to, go execute, and then they're just going on a backlog somewhere. And so the question is like, are they just being, really overly optimistic about like the crazy grandiose things that they could actually be doing to solve these problems? Or is it just that like, there's not enough energy being put into executing the follow-ups? And I think that's something that like really leadership needs to be tapped into, because, like anything else, we're making a choice about how fast do we go in terms of product or feature, improvement versus, keeping the lights on, like buying down some of the tech debt we have. If you're an engineering leader within that space, like keeping a close monitor on incident follow-ups and, how quickly they're getting responded to, how many of them are, I think is really critical.
Yeah. Listeners, press pause, rewind 20 seconds and play that one again. It is so, so important to make sure that you're actually following up on findings from incidents with a certain level of urgency. One of the things that I had to do in my experience, and outside of Meta, just in general around this stuff, was to work with engineering management to make sure that that corpus of work has an incentive behind it. And, at Meta, it was a bit easier because, the way that our performance was evaluated, we had the 4 quadrants and one was engineering excellence. So we, if an engineer didn't contribute to engineering excellence, typically in the form of, participating in sev review and acting on the follow-ups, well, they're not going to have a large amount of body there, and that might affect their rating. So I'm just making sure that you're tying team incentives to the behavior that you want, which is following up on these risks, is a big missing piece of the puzzle when it comes to reliability posture for a team.
Yeah, could not agree more. I think one of the things we've also, one of the challenges we've had to have is like to recreate that culture that Meta has of, how do you actually prioritize reliability? That can be a hard thing, in a smaller, company where you're much closer to the business needs and, the requests from like product engineers. Whereas, at Meta, you have the benefit of like 10 years of archaeology that kind of says like, go to, go do your incident follow-ups. That's the highest priority thing. And I think the other aspect of this that probably hits really home for, platform and infrastructure engineers is that a lot of times the work that platform and, infrastructure are doing might be 100%, incident follow-ups or, architectural buy-down. And so I think it also merits, thinking about how you create a culture where there could be engineers that entire focus is reliability, that may not be shipping something that's bringing in more revenue or reducing costs or improving performance, and being able to create pathways for those people to be successful, if they are actually bringing in value is really critical.
Yeah, 100%. And I mean, like managing risk from incidents is a cost reduction exercise, right? And it also protects the revenue that you currently have. It's hard to articulate. It's so much easier to say, oh, we have this new feature, we sold a deal. That feature is worth $1 million. But it's probably very true that the reliability work that engineering is doing is probably holding on to comparable revenue. It's just, it's harder to express and explain.
Yeah, you can't. It's hard to say like X engineer, didn't have 20 sevs happen because of the awesome work that they did. And so that's where like your job as, engineering leadership or a more senior, engineering IC is like learning how to document that work and socialize it and tell a story around like why it's important and, like excellent. It's something I'm definitely still learning, something that, I think is the challenge of our role. Right.
Yeah, for sure. For sure. Something that requires a lot of time and passion. So let's double down on this subject. At SevZero conference last year, that's where I met you. You did a very awesome short and sweet talk called Stop, Drop, and Sev 4, Why Small Incidents Are a Big Deal. So mind taking a few minutes to explain why we should treat our small production incidents with care rather than being flippant or indifferent about them?
Yeah, definitely. I think the talk is online. It's hopefully short and sweet. I think there's a lot of reasons why we should kind of embrace the Sev 4, Sev 3, depending on what organization. The first is, I think, engineers kind of have an inhibition against creating incidents because they seem like a big deal, right? Like the second I click that launch incident button, I kind of know, like from a Pavlov sense, that I'm gonna have to go file a postmortem at some point, and that's not me doing work. Sure. And so if we have a lower incident tier that maybe has lower postmortem requirements, you get people to file the incidents faster, and then that leads to a whole bunch of benefits. The first being, it gets people in the room quicker. And ultimately, if we're talking about how quickly are we resolving incidents so that we can get ourselves back on SLO track, that's critical. And the other thing is, like, most of us are paying a lot of money for an incident management platform. And it has a lot of great, discovery, documentation, communication, investigation tooling. Why limit yourself to only very high criticality incidents? Like, use all of that tooling, which you're not paying per incident. Like, use all that tooling as part of your investigation process, and you'll get to resolution much more quickly. And then I think there's also some like kind of follow-on benefits to this as well. One thing is that it gives people the chance to like exercise those muscles of incident management. If the first time that a product team is ever dealing with an incident is that, Sev 0, Sev 1 incident where the product is down, they're not going to do a great job of navigating the tooling and doing the communication. If you treat the Sev 2, Sev 3, Sev 4 as like a field day exercise, then they're developing those muscles and skills in a lower risk environment. And then I think it also kind of creates documentation for itself. So a lot of times we've seen, a Sev 4 incident come back to be a Sev 2 incident or a Sev 1 incident. And so it makes the process of like figuring out what you need to do to mitigate and like finding the right owners and all that stuff a little bit easier. It maybe helps you identify the risks earlier. And then actually relating to the last conversation, it's been really great as a kind of performance tool where I have, you know, there's definitely engineers on my team who spend, myself included, who spend a significant chunk of their workday dealing with incidents and postmortems and follow-ups. And so having the documentation, not only for the Sev0 incidents, but also the Sev4 things that were consuming their time is great to be able to say, like, yeah, these are these like really deep, technically excellent investigations that they alone could do. And here's the big old list during performance review. And you can really reward that you know, strong effort.
Yeah, that really is the key. I mean, using the tools creates artifacts of activity that you can then map to, yeah, this is why I deserve that bonus, boss. Very, very straightforward. Yeah, and there's so many opportunities to file that low urgency Sev, that Sev4. A typical one that I use is any production change that is potentially disruptive. Maybe we're doing a schema change. Maybe we're doing a load test where it's against production. We're actually inducing load against prod. We're consuming resources. Something might go wrong. So just having the level of readiness and awareness and using the tool, yeah, you're building the ability to quickly jump in if something does in fact go wrong. And then you're also developing the muscles on how to do incidents in general. There's just no reason to not.
That's actually, I think that's something that I think we probably both experienced as Metas. A part of their culture is that they have these kind of pre-mortem or like anticipatory incidents where you're basically, yeah, you're filing the Sev, usually I think at Meta would be like a Sev3 or, yeah, I think it was Sev3, like file a low-level incident. And that way you're using all the blast communication that incident does and like all the coordination that you get out of the incident tooling. As part of your process of doing a release. And actually our tooling recently at Plaid has actually evolved. So that's like a first class feature where instead of filing an incident, you're filing like a change or a maintenance like object, if you will. And so it's doing all the same things. It's like providing communication. It's giving you like all the tie-ins and a VC and all the good stuff without freaking out all your coworkers that there's, you know, been some incident and not affecting the metrics that you have for, you know, number of incidents and stuff like that. I think that's a really exciting direction. It's maybe not the most intuitive out of the box, but yeah. I think that experience is starting to feel a lot more polished.
Yeah. And just for Linsiter's benefit, this is not a new practice. Maybe it's a newer practice in software engineering and running SaaS and being on call, but there's entirely different industries that operate this way. I mean, the most classic example is Toyota with the Andon cord, where if anything goes wrong on the production line from the perspective of someone that is, you know, on the actual production line and helping produce a vehicle, you pull a cable. Now, granted, it's not a cable anymore, but the effect of doing that is you stop the entire production line. Management comes to you, they say thank you, and they ask you what's going on so that they can fix it. In order to do that, there has to be a culture of people willing to report when the small things are happening. And the outcome, of course, as we all know, is that Toyota is the most reliable vehicle manufacturer on planet Earth, period, over and out. I'm literally standing in one recording this podcast, you know, in my micro camper in the middle of the desert.
We think about what we're evolving in, like, especially incident management and monitoring is like very new, but it is really a well-beaten path in many other industries. Yeah. One of the ones I kind of borrow from a lot is kind of the world of aviation. Yeah. I think there's a great TV shows about like air crashes and how those investigations happen. And it's a routine practice there that like, you know, before you're starting an engine, before you're coming in for, you know, approach, you are going through, where are you diverting to if there's issues, like what, you know, what's the go around speed? Like you're thinking through that. It's precisely what we do in a pre-mortem. Mm-hmm. We just as software engineers think of ourselves as like unique and special and that we've invented this whole doctrine, but it truly is just borrowing from other things.
Good job on deflating all of our egos. Nothing is new under the sun. We're just excavating things that people have known for decades.
I mean, absolutely. But I think the benefit to the listener, right, is like the second you kind of have that bubble burst and realize like, okay, this isn't actually all that new. It opens up a wealth of literature that you can actually go be reading. And, you know, number one, it's like, it's fascinating because it's not the stuff you do every day, but sure, it is stuff that you can kind of borrow from. And, you know, there's a ton of talks in our space about, you know, one at Sub-Zero about how like Chernobyl, Fukushima was how that kind of can be taken as an incident management lesson. I think there's tons, you know, in the FEMA world as well of like how, you know, our government has developed these procedures for dealing with like natural disasters. And those are very directly applicable to, you know, incident management in like the security or the like privacy or reliability sense.
Yeah, that's a very good point. I will definitely link to those materials in the show notes. Your talk, of course, short and sweet, but the talk at SevZero about the Fukushima Daiichi disaster, and the detailed, social explanation of what was going on during that incident is absolutely huge. But yes, those industries have so much for us to learn from, for sure. All right, I'm going to give you an opportunity with the remaining minutes of the podcast to really, have some hot takes. So I got a question prepped for you, kind of knowing the answer. Of course. Of course. So we dabbled a little bit in platform engineering. So basically we're producing a infrastructure services for other teams to consume to create, customer-facing services. So how from the platform engineering perspective, further down in the stack, how should we monitor the state of production health?
Yeah, it's a good question. I think really one of the reasons I think we evolved towards this platform model is kind of the scope of your awareness as an engineer. In the early days, you kind of had these like site ops and site master kind of personalities where you were responsible for everything that happened at the company, and so you were handed code and maybe it was tested, maybe it wasn't, and you were deploying it and you were the one fixing it if it broke. And we've evolved away to the SRE production engineering, platform engineering model because that's just too much scope for one person to have. I mean, you want that responsibility for like testing and monitoring and quality to live, as close to the people actually building the system as possible. And so I guess my hot take in this is that as a platform engineer, I really don't care about product level metrics, because that's the responsibility of the product engineers that are building the products. And so I guess what I'm thinking about is I'm building this platform. I have SLOs and features that I'm providing to my customers, who would be the product engineers and people building on top of the platform. And certainly if those things are breaking, then I need to go dive in and fix it. But really, I think if you kind of burden the platform team with being responsible for all these product metrics, you kind of create a sort of paralysis where they just have too many knobs to look at or to turn, too many things to look at, and you kind of end up back in the days of like the site ops webmaster central DevOps team. And so yeah, spicy take is don't do not concern yourself too much with product metrics. Like certainly ask product owners to create those for you and like monitor them when you are making changes to those systems. But those shouldn't be something you're getting called paged for sure.
Yeah, I'm right with you on this one. And just to elucidate it a little bit further for the benefit of listeners, when a platform team becomes responsible for top level, product reliability metrics, you are kind of like breaking the fourth wall. You're giving them more scope than they're able to handle, and that is a very easy way for a platform engineering team to devolve into system administration and ops. There needs to be that well-defined scope where I am providing these services. This is the latency and availability guarantees that I'm giving you, and that is all I'm responsible for. So definitely be careful as to what metrics you give your platform teams. It should be only to their scope, strictly defined. Otherwise, yeah, you're running an ops team, which is really, really scary.
I guess just to add the asterisk too, like we're not the only ones that have this problem. Like plenty
Oh,
of
no.
product teams depend on other products, right? And so I think it's the same thing where really the general principle is that you want a team of people to have a well understood set of things that they're responsible for. And when you give them responsibility over SLOs that they can't control, you're basically putting them on the hook to like learn systems that they didn't engineer or didn't document or have no monitoring or like observability on. And that's just not a good way of like preparing them for when the incident strikes. And so like clear division of responsibility is kind of the theme of like why you shouldn't have platform engineers monitoring product SLOs.
Yeah, 100%. 100%. So we're taking this plane down for a landing. We spent a good, almost solid hour reminiscing about our days in big tech and all the cool tools and all the things we've learned and, just all the interesting stuff about yourself, of course. If people are interested in talking to you more, maybe learn a little bit more about your experience, maybe learn a little bit more about Plaid, how can they reach you?
Yeah, I will drop my LinkedIn link in the show notes, and yeah, definitely reach out. Love having these conversations. I mean, that's how I'm on this podcast is one of those ad hoc conversations. So welcome all of those. It is a remarkably small world, and so it's really cool to kind of join the community and talk more at the KubeCons and other conferences as well.
Yeah, certainly. Derek, it has been a pleasure, sir. I hope I see you in person at a future conference. Thank you so much, buddy.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to today's edition of Reliability Rebels. Until next time.
Check one, check two.
Reliability Rebels.
Check one, check two.
Reliability Rebels.
Check, 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 check,